Support for Out in the Bay comes from Comcast, dedicated to serving California communities with access to technology, volunteering time, providing financial support, and connecting people in need to high-speed internet at home. More at california.comcast.com. Hello and welcome to Out in the Bay, queer radio from San Francisco. I'm Eric Jansen. I'm joined today by disability activist and Bay Area rabbi Elliot Kukla, author of a recent opinion piece in the New York Times entitled, My Life is More Disposable During This Pandemic. Rabbi Kukla is no stranger to sheltering in place. He has been living with a chronic debilitating illness for years now and spends much of his time at home. The first openly transgender rabbi ordained by a mainstream Jewish movement, Kukla now works at the Bay Area Jewish Healing Center in San Francisco, where he has been providing spiritual care to the ill, dying, and bereaved since 2008, and intermittently from his home since 2013. Rabbi Kukla has written on a wide variety of topics, including spirituality, Judaism, gender diversity, healing, and chronic illness. In his March op-ed, Rabbi Kukla discusses how COVID-19 has unmasked the ageism and ableism that exists in Western culture. He compares current attitudes and language used to address the pandemic to similar rhetoric common in Nazi Germany during the 1930s and 40s. Rabbi Kukla not only highlights the discrimination embedded in our culture, policy, and practices, he also emphasizes what we can all learn from the chronically ill, disabled, and elderly during this time. Welcome, Rabbi Kukla.
Thank you. So good to be here.
So you have prepared a short piece of part of your essay from March that you'd like to read. We'd love to hear that.
I did. Thank you. I will start with that. The feeling of being disposable is not new to me. It is knitted into my bones and sinews. It lives in my cells and the parasites in my gut. I already knew that for many of the doctors and policymakers that my health depends on, that my transgender, fat, disabled body is simply worth less than others' bodies. This is even more true for my Black, brown, poor, disabled, and ill friends. Each message of disposability in this pandemic rings like a bell in the hollows of my body, surfacing memories. In 1990, when I was 15 years old, I came out as queer into a pandemic, as AIDS was ravaging communities across the globe. My first pride parades were not joyful celebrations, but rageful protests as we demanded healthcare, medicine, witnessing. My queer uncles died before I was 20, but taught me on the way out not to trust governments or doctors, and that marginalized people must take care of one another. My first lesson in adulthood was that love is our only source of security. The Nazis called chronically ill and disabled people useless eaters and killed us first. This used to seem like ancient history to me, but as I age, the scope of time shrinks. My father hid from Nazis as a child in Belgium, and I was born just 33 years later. His history was as recent to my early childhood as George Michael at the top of the charts is to today. Scientists now believe that there are cellular changes in the DNA of the children of Holocaust survivors that most likely impact our health. My father's story lives in my overactive immune system and thus my body's response to this pandemic right now. As a disabled Jewish second-generation Holocaust survivor, the words useless eater are practically in my DNA. I can taste the tang of them in my mouth as I read the news. In the bitterness of Italy's policies, in this country's callous healthcare, and affluent people refusing to listen to sick and disabled voices and stay home when they can afford to, in the dismissive internet comments that only the sick and old need to worry, so who cares? My cells remember other things too, that to survive illness and trauma, whether individual or communal, we need one another, including strangers. When my father was 2 years old, hiding from Nazis in a Christian foster home, he developed a loud case of whooping cough. He was dropped unceremoniously at the doors of a Belgian nunnery. These women nursed him back to health and returned him a few months later, fully recovered. I wish I knew their names, these faceless women to whom I owe my existence, who cared for him, bathed him, changed him, powdered him.
Very good. Thank you. That was Rabbi Elliot Kukla reading from his March New York Times opinion piece called My Life is More Disposable During This Pandemic. Rabbi, you've been writing about disability for quite some time now. In a New York Times opinion piece 2 years earlier, in January 2018, you discussed your diagnosis with lupus, a serious autoimmune disorder that affects your body and nervous system. So if you would, please share with our listeners how you came to be diagnosed with lupus.
Well, it was quite a journey, as diagnosis is for most people with chronic illness. I had experienced chronic illness since early childhood, but like a lot of people with chronic illness in our culture, I pushed through for decades upon decades because there simply wasn't space in my life for illness. I think a lot of us experience that in capitalist society, that we keep pushing through chronic illness until that becomes absolutely impossible. And in 2013, after really decades of months at a time of serious fatigue and not being able to function, but then pushing through and continuing to kind of pass as able-bodied, I experienced a sort of total physical collapse in 2013, and ended up so sick that I, for a while, couldn't remember my wife's name and, you know, had trouble finding my way around my house and had debilitating pain. And at that point, I started looking for a diagnosis. And that diagnosis was hard to find, as it often is for people with complex illness. And what happened to me almost immediately when that diagnosis didn't come immediately is that I stopped being believed as a reliable reporter about my body. And I had seen this happen to countless clients and friends and community members in disability community, and I knew this is what happens to people with complex illness, especially people who the illness is more invisible. And I still thought that it wouldn't happen to me in the same way because of the fact that I was working in the healthcare system at the time. I was a rabbi and a chaplain, and I had been working in hospitals and hospice and nursing homes for almost a decade. I knew the language of how to present myself, and I was used to being taken seriously on medical teams. And I thought that I could avoid the intense disbelief that surrounds chronic illness, but I couldn't. Almost immediately, I was treated as unreliable. I would go to the ER with intense pain so bad that I couldn't speak and be treated as a drug seeker. I went through the same kind of gaslighting and pathologizing that pretty much everyone does around invisible chronic illness. And it was only because my partner, my wife, was a really incredible and tireless medical advocate, which not everyone has, that I eventually did receive a lupus diagnosis. But I have to say that even with a lupus diagnosis, I often found myself in the healthcare system describing my symptoms and having medical professionals say to me, no, that couldn't possibly happen. And soon having conversations with many other people with lupus and finding common ground that many of us were experiencing similar symptoms and being told that we were not reliable reporters about our bodies. And this is something that happens to sick people.
It is so important, and sounds like you were lucky to have a strong advocate with you.
Yeah.
I also, from this essay from January 2018, you describe your friends even telling you, oh, you just have to fight harder for a cure.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, you kind of let go of looking for a cure and settled into, okay, I'm ill, I'm going to settle into that. What relief did that bring you?
Enormous relief. Everyone tells you to look for a cure when you have an incurable illness. despite the obvious paradox of that, despite the fact that we know that some illnesses are incurable, it's very hard for people to accept the notion that illness is sometimes a place to live, that it's not always a stopover, that illness isn't always a way to recovery or a pathway to death, that sometimes illness is a place to live, that sometimes illness is a place to make a home. And we live in a culture that is very much believes in personal responsibility, that everything is personal responsibility and everything is personal control. And we're even seeing that in COVID. We're even seeing the idea that people who are dying of COVID, who have been forced by economic circumstances and systemic racism to be working in the front line, like we're seeing with there being so many greater rates of people of color dying of COVID, instead of talking about systemic racism leading to that, we're saying things like, people of color have worse health habits. People of color are fat. People of color eat. That is very much part of the rhetoric. We want to believe that if only people had greater willpower and could control their bodies more, they wouldn't be sick. And in fact, illness just happens. Illness is part of human diversity. And also systemic injustice contributes to illness. But we want to believe that illness is all about personal responsibility. And I think underlying this is this deep fear that if it could happen to me, Elliot, then it could happen to you any moment too, that there is this element of utter lack of control of our bodies that chronic illness reveals that's also related to the fact that we all die. That is very terrifying for people. So there's an onslaught of advice that comes with chronic illness, an onslaught of, have you tried yoga? Have you tried acupuncture? Have you tried kale smoothies? Have you tried this medication or that medication? Even when you're dealing with an illness that is clearly incurable.
Yeah, wow. I mean, I think that is true. People want to see you or another person in their life with something incurable makes them afraid. So they want you to get better so that they are not afraid of getting sick themselves.
Absolutely.
Incurably sick. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about the work that you do at the Bay Area Jewish Healing Center. I'm curious to know especially how COVID-19 has changed your work. But before that, what are the basics of what you do?
Well, we are a team of four rabbis. I'm one of the four, and we serve the entire Bay Area for anything to do with grieving, illness, or dying. So we serve individuals and hospices and nursing homes. I co-direct Kol HaNishama, which is our hospice end-of-life spiritual care volunteer program in collaboration with the Campus for Jewish Living. And we also run nursing homes. We run a bereavement weekend, which is called Grief and Growing. So anything that has to do with the spiritual care of those who are grieving, ill, or coming to the end of life.
Wow, that's a lot.
Yeah.
And it sounds like very important and amazing work.
Thank you.
So you have, you've watched COVID spread, and I wondered what your fears and thoughts were as this was starting to unfold, February, March, about the time you wrote this opinion piece. Mm-hmm. Have those fears come to pass? Are they worse, better? How are you seeing things pan out?
Sadly, they're panning out pretty much like I expected Well, in some ways, like I expected, and like most people in sick and disabled community expected. From very early on, those of us in sick and disabled community were very alarmed, feeling like this country was not prepared, which has turned out to be true, and that there was deep ableism in this country that was not prioritizing sick and disabled lives. That was very clear from the earliest messaging that went out. The very earliest messaging that went out said, don't worry, only chronically ill and old people are at risk of dying. So it's really no big deal, which was from the beginning very alarming for us and communicated this ethic of disposability. And we started hearing reports from Italy where there were triage policies that explicitly took into account things that, like life years, that meant elder lives were not being protected, and things like quality of life that have long been used to say that disabled lives are not as valuable. And we know from years of research in medical ethics that the notion of quality of life is usually weaponized against disabled people, that how disabled people understand their quality of life is usually very different than how able-bodied people understand disabled people's quality of life. And we're seeing that extremely strongly with COVID, that doctors across the country are making calls and saying, pressuring disabled and chronically ill people to have DNRs in their files, sometimes outright refusing to treat disabled and sick people, pushing this notion of quality of life on family members, even when family members very explicitly say, my disabled family member does have quality of life. They're a loving, active family member. We've also seen explicitly in some states discriminatory policies towards people with cognitive disabilities, and all of our worst fears really coming to play. I think what I didn't predict as strongly as it's come to pass, and I would say the reason I didn't is because of my white privilege, is how strongly COVID has revealed racism in this country and race-based health disparities, that how much more strongly COVID has impacted people of color in this country. And of course, in this conversation, disabled people of color and chronically ill people of color are being impacted the most, that all of these clusters of racism and ableism and ageism are coming together in terms of how disabled, sick, and elders who are also people of color are dying at really terrifying rates in this country. And there's a terrifying lack of care about that.
Can you describe some of those disparities, racial disparities and inequalities in the public health care system that you're seeing that COVID-19 is revealing?
There are a lot of health conditions that are connected to poverty, systemic racism, and economic injustice. So people of color are not able to shelter in place in the same rates as white people. People of color are less likely to have the same kind of health insurance. It's really a cluster of all of the deep, deep white supremacy of this country that's leading to what I would really call a genocide. I know that's an extremely strong word, but we're looking at 120,000 people who have died so far in this country and not strong public health action, which a lot of genocides have happened. If you look at history, like the Irish potato famine, through leaders in action. Genocide isn't always active killing. Sometimes it's leaders of a country just refusing to respond. And if we look at the rates in which disabled and elder people of color are dying right now, it feels like a genocide to me. Mm-hmm. And it's terrifying.
Yes, absolutely. It seems a little reminiscent of the inaction that we saw during the early years of the AIDS epidemic, for example, from the federal government. You're listening to Out in the Bay. My guest today is Elliot Kukla, disability activist and rabbi at the Bay Area Jewish Healing Center in San Francisco. He's the author of a March opinion piece in the New York Times entitled, My Life is More Disposable During This Pandemic, and is with us to discuss ageism, ableism, and spirituality during the COVID-19 pandemic. How has your work and the clients, the people you work with, how has COVID-19 changed the situation and what they're talking to you, the concerns they're bringing to you?
Mm-hmm. Well, it has changed things in that things are all virtual right now. which is not new for me. There have been times in my life before where I have done all my work virtually, but for a lot of my clients, that's new. So there is something happening right now for a lot of disabled people where it feels like a lot of the able-bodied world is joining us. So there is a feeling of welcome to my world, which is very interesting and sometimes exciting and sometimes uncomfortable. A feeling of a lot of able-bodied people struggling to adjust to many of the things that disabled people have been experiencing for a long time, like limitations on mobility and discovering some of the deep limits of institutional safety net in this country, like the limits of our healthcare system, and discovering things like life can change in an instant. So a lot of my clients already knew that because they were already sick and disabled, but now it's something that everyone is experiencing in this country. So a lot of my client conversations, people are struggling with things on a communal level that for me used to be very individual private experiences or things experienced just in disability community or things that just were something that an individual client was going through. And now they're being experienced on this entire communal level. So there, that is, it both destigmatizes some of these experiences of illness, and it can be very overwhelming. And I think this is one of those places where individual illness and disability could really prepare you for where we are communally right now.
So, boy, that brings up a lot of questions.
It really does. It really does.
You know, a few have gone through my mind. One is, well, what can we learn? What can all of us learn from what disabled and chronically ill people have been going through for a long time? That's one question. And the other question is the denial that you were talking about. And do you think that's part of the reason we're seeing in this country, especially, a rise again in COVID cases and people not wearing masks and on and on?
So there's a lot of answers because there's a lot of questions. So first of all, I think it's no accident that I've learned the most from disabled people of color, and disabled people of color are the most at risk in this moment of planetary crisis, because I do believe that people who are closest to the problem are closest to the solution, and that disabled people of color have already been in a pandemic of white supremacy and in a pandemic that has led to struggling for survival in a way that we're all experiencing right now. I think there's so much to learn in terms of the value of staying home, the value of doing less that disabled people have known for a long time, that doing nothing is sometimes the most powerful thing you can do. That really goes counter to capitalist society, which is something I really needed to learn when I was sick as well, and is a Jewish value as well, that rest is a creative action. It's part of creation. And rest is central to disability justice. Another key thing that goes with disability that the whole world needs right now, and particularly this country, is breaking through the myth of independence. We tend to hold independence on a pedestal. And I think that goes to the second part of your question in terms of denial, of people wanting to go about their life the way that they used to live it. And I think a lot of what people are craving right now is feeling like they're independent, that they can go and do what they wanted to do like before, to have that feeling of independence and freedom. But that independence was always a myth. That independence was always based on driving on roads that other people built and eating food that other people picked and other people harvested and driving on planes that other people took the oil out of the earth for. And there's always been huge labor consequences for every one of those acts that felt independent to us. And pandemic reveals the costs of that labor. pandemic reveals the risks for the people who do that labor, and suddenly that labor isn't faceless anymore. Suddenly we need to see that we depend on all these people when those people are at risk for doing those jobs for us. And a lot of the people who are in denial right now and fighting against this and saying, I need a haircut, cannot deal with the fact that they're interconnected with the mostly poor brown and black people who usually provide those services for survival, in my opinion. They're fighting to maintain that myth of independence. And instead of grappling with the fact that we're interconnected, are trying to go back to a place where services can be provided facelessly. And that means turning the people who do those services into objects whose lives and their families' lives can be sacrificed.
I wonder if you have any sense of hope as a silver lining in this COVID-19 pandemic. It does seem like everybody is having to rethink, like, oh, what the heck's going on in the world and what can we do to fix it? Do you have a hope that there will be real substantive change?
So first of all, this moment of collapse when thousands of people are dying, hundreds of thousands on a global level are dying, a lot of them needlessly due to political mismanagement, there's no silver lining there. And we're in so much collapse right now that we have an opportunity to build something totally new. And I think that pandemic has revealed that normal is not a good thing, that we don't want to go back to normal, that normal was a glass of milk on the edge of the table waiting to fall back, that this pandemic was about to start. And if not this pandemic, another virus. And if not this virus, fires and floods of climate chaos, that our culture was at an unsustainable tipping point and we need something new.
Very good. Thank you. You have a book you're working on now. Can you tell us briefly what that's about?
Yes, I am working on a book on being chronically ill in a time of planetary crisis. Which is about many of these themes we've discussed today, about how being chronically ill and disabled places us both at the forefront of risk in planetary crisis, including pandemic and climate chaos, and also offers survival skills and embodied wisdom that everyone can benefit from in this moment.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. My guest today has been disability activist and Bay Area Rabbi Elliot Kukla, a spiritual counselor at the Bay Area Jewish Healing Center in San Francisco. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. It was so good to be here. Thanks for having me.
For links to the articles mentioned in today's conversation, please see our website, outinthebay.org, where you can also hear this program again, as well as past shows, and share them with your friends. While you're there, please sign up for our e-news and subscribe to our podcast, outinthebay.org. Have a question, comment, or suggestion? What do you want to hear next? You can find us on Facebook at Out in the Bay and on Twitter and Instagram at OutInTheBaySF, or write to us, outinthebaysf@gmail.com. Today's show was produced by Kendra Klang. Our theme music was written and performed by Holly Mead. Out in the Bay is brought to you in part by Comcast. A big thank you to KSFP for bringing Out in the Bay back on the air. I'm Eric Jansen. Thank you for listening and take good care.
Support for Out in the Bay comes from Comcast, dedicated to serving California communities with access to technology, volunteering time, providing financial support, and connecting people in need to high-speed internet at home. More at california.comcast.com.